everyone. Welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And we are back for our March episode with a film I am very excited to talk about.
Well, you would be because you chose it.
I did. It was my choice. You won it. I won this choice. And we're going to talk about, I want to say it's a real, like, quiet favorite of mine. It's not a film I've returned to again and again. I've watched it several times over the years. But in the last year, 2 years, I've really had a renaissance with the filmmaker Michael Mann. And I've just fully established in my own heart and mind that he is probably my favorite American filmmaker, or at least one of them.
Okay.
But yeah, it all kind of kicked off when I went to a rep cinema in Hamilton, Ontario with my parents. And we went to see Michael Mann's first film, Thief, mm-hmm. with James Caan. Have you ever seen that?
No. I can't think of another Michael Mann film that I've seen.
Oh, well, I'll walk you through some of them. But yeah. Andrea, you know how last episode you were like, oh, fuck me, Oliver Reed, Urban Grandier.
Fuck me, Oliver Reed was the thrust of the episode,
it
I dare say.
It truly was a thrust.
At least my contribution to it.
And I have to say that for me, I think, like, I have that same reaction to James Caan in Thief.
Okay.
It's like a crime story, but it's also about the economics of crime and workers' rights and all of this stuff. And it just, oh boy, when he talks about the labor that he has produced in this crime, I get all hot and bothered.
Okay.
I can see my money is still in your pocket, which is from the yield of my labor.
Hot slurp.
But Michael Mann is, to me, a very, very important filmmaker in the 20th century. He kicked it off with Thief. He made a very weird horror film called The Keep, which...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I want to love it more than I do, but it was definitely, I think, an interesting exercise. Then he really starts to get into the flow a little bit more with this film, Manhunter. I think he's best known for his film Heat.
Oh, yeah.
With Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, which is one of the great American films mm-hmm. of all time, I think. I just rewatched it, and I'm like, it's so fucking good. I can't even handle it. Other great films like The Insider, Collateral. I even really liked his film version of Miami Vice, mm. which he was actually the producer on the TV show. So he has a long lineage with that property. And so more recently, he's done a few things that have done less well. He had a big film come out around Christmas in Ferrari, which I didn't hear great things about, so I still haven't seen it. I will get to it. But he is really known for his visual style, this kind of film frames that are filled with neon colors, and really, really interesting placement of characters within large cityscapes. He's incredible, in my opinion, at action sequences. Like, the action sequences in Heat are unparalleled in my mind. And I think he has a real thing about male characters.
Seems like a lot of cop films, from what I'm hearing.
Yeah, it's something he was always kind of interested in, so it's always permeated his filmography, and he's always come at it from different ways, like from the point of view of the detectives, from the point of view of the criminals, and he's usually not coming down on one side is the good side and one side is the bad side. I think we have a bit more black and white in Manhunter, but for the majority of his films, there's a really big gray area of moral ambiguity in the midst of this, you know, incredibly beautiful, stylized visual aesthetic that he creates and the music that he uses. Like, Thief is incredible because it's about this, like, workaday guy who breaks into bank vaults, but all the music is done by Tangerine Dream.
Oh.
So it's this very, again, like, dream-esque landscape of what it is to be a criminal.
Okay.
And it's to me, it's fascinating. So I have a lot of love and I have a lot of time for Michael Mann. If you're on our Patreon, you've heard me shit talk the now Oscar winning film Oppenheimer, because Christopher Nolan is, you know, a film director who's very celebrated in his own right, but he cannot write or conceive of female characters in an interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, Michael Mann makes films about men. And to me, he makes films about men struggling with masculinity,
mm-hmm.
toxic masculinity, good masculinity, their own version of masculinity. His films are obsessed with that. And I think that's really interesting, especially in the kind of machismo cop crime thriller stuff that he tends to do. But I also really like that, you know, and I feel like you might enjoy it less, but I often find he has a lot of empathy and time for the female characters in his films. Usually they are wives and girlfriends most of the time, but they are, generally speaking, pretty well-rounded. They're very empathetic. These actresses give great performances. I was reminded of how incredible Ashley Judd is in Heat. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a scene where she does nothing but look off in the distance, knowing that she's lost someone forever. Mm-hmm. And she just, like, these tears slowly well up in her eyes, and they well up in my eyes. And I'm like, this is, like, a moment. This is really exciting to watch.
Why would you think I wouldn't like something like that?
I don't know. You get a little hinky around the wives and the girlfriends in the films. And that's fair enough. I get hinky around them, too. Uh-huh. I feel like Michael Mann knows what he wants to say, but he's not going to denigrate the female characters.
Yeah.
Even rewatching Collateral, which I did recently, like Jada Pinkett Smith, who's the, you know, plays a small supporting role, but of the potential girlfriend in the film, she is smart, she's funny, she's charming, she's cool. Like, something really great about that. I think he sees women as full characters, even if they're not the leads.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's definitely a way to do a police procedural film that really minimizes women, that really reduces masculinity to guns and no gun, dick gets soft type thing. And speaking for Manhunter, I really think that's the case.
Yeah. And what's your history with Manhunter?
Well, the Thomas Harris books went through me back in the teenage days. I didn't remember a whole lot of specifics, and I didn't find the time to go back to the original text. But I am really excited to go back to this one because I realized that we talked about Silence of the Lambs in one of our earliest episodes of the podcast before we had entirely found our footing. Like, you know, I think we talked about the main themes at length, and like Manhunter is among the reading materials. So like we did talk about it, but I think in rewatching some of these films, I definitely had way different reactions in 2024. And so, yeah, I think it's really worth revisiting now.
All right. So let's dive in. This is Michael Mann's Manhunter from 1986.
Intruder entered through kitchen sliding door.
Nationwide victims.
Yeah, this is Will Graham of the FBI.
One killer.
This is what the subject's teeth look like.
William, you're gonna make yourself sick or get yourself killed.
Multiple trails.
Just you and me now, sport.
One hunter.
I'm gonna find you, damn it.
FBI agent Will Graham, Manhunter.
Former FBI criminal profiler Will Graham is brought back into the Bureau as they face a string of killings they can't seem to crack. The killer, dubbed the Tooth Fairy, breaks and enters into families' homes, murders the family, and brutalizes the matriarch. With the killer operating on a lunar schedule, Graham is running out of time and pays a visit to the infamous Hannibal Lecter, who he helped put behind bars. While Lecter taunts him, he does provide Graham with some insights, and they find the killer has been in communication with Lecter via personal ads in the National Tattler. The FBI uses tabloid journalist Freddie Lowndes to lure the killer out, with Graham giving an interview that implies the killer is homosexual. This enrages the killer, whose name is Francis Dollarhide, who kidnaps and tortures Lowndes, who eventually succumbs to his injuries. Dollarhide works at a film lab and begins a relationship with his coworker, Reba, who is blind. Graham realizes, based on the killer's movements through the house and the tools he used to break in, he must have access to the family's home movies. Graham and the team track down Dollarhide, and in a final confrontation, Graham manages to kill Dollarhide before he can hurt Reba.
So, top line notes, props to you for pronouncing it Lecter and not Lector, because the way they spell it in this film, I can't not say it like that.
Yeah, there's a K. There's a K in this one.
There's a K, and I feel like the first time it's uttered is by, like, a random cop character who's like, Lector. And I was like, what the fuck? But it's Lecter. It's the same guy, played by a different guy. And I think Brian Cox is an amazing Lecter.
He is my favorite Lecter.
No kidding.
He is my favorite Lecter. We can talk a bit more about that later on when we dive into the character. Mm-hmm. But again, as people who listen to this podcast and our Patreon know, I'm a huge Succession fan. I've been a fan of Brian Cox for a really long time. And there's something about this version of Lecter that really scares me.
Mm-hmm.
That really deeply unsettles me.
He's chilling. And I think part of that is because Will Graham is so physically uncomfortable around him.
Yeah.
He's jittery. He's jumpy. He's, okay, I'm out the door. And Lecter will be like, wait.
Dream much, Will. Goodbye, Dr. Lecter. You haven't threatened to take away my books yet.
But let's maybe start by going back to the written word. Before this was a huge multi-gazillion dollar Oscar-winning film series, it was a series of paperback books by one Thomas Harris.
Yeah, so this series kicks off with the release of Red Dragon in 1981, which is what Manhunter is based on. They changed the name because another film had come out the year prior with the word dragon in it, and it hadn't done well. So they figured Manhunter. That's cool. And then Silence of the Lambs, the novel, came out in 1988 with Hannibal, the sequel to Silence of the Lambs, coming out in 99. And then the prequel to all of this called Hannibal Rising came out in 2006. And then on top of that, Harris has written like two other novels that have nothing to do but are also kind of crime thrillers.
Yeah, his very first and his very last, yeah. From what I understand, that the Silence of the Lambs saga takes place right in the middle of his bibliography, which is quite brief. Like, I think, you know, he's famous, and rightfully so, for being the author of this series, but he hasn't had a tremendous Stephen King-y output.
No, and he's a figure who is quite elusive. Mm-hmm. I found in my research that the last seemingly full interview he did was in 1976, and he's just a recluse. He lives with his partner, they've got a few houses, and they just kind of bop around being bon vivants and hanging out at dinner parties and being very charming, apparently.
Yeah, he looks like a cuddly older man. He looks like the kind of guy who, like, his glasses don't come off.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he sleeps with them on. But it made me think, so we'll talk a little bit later about a lot of the issues. We have a lot of the issues that the communities at large have with these stories. Mm-hmm. So don't worry, we're going to talk about that. But it made me think about this idea of being the recluse and the privilege of being a recluse. Because Andrea and I had the opportunity to do a talk with this really wonderful honors class at the University of Chattanooga last week.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, they're studying the humanities, and it was, you know, how do you take something that's academic and make it really public facing, which has always been our goal with the Faculty of Horror. And in the last week, I've been thinking about Harris just being able to, like, live in his houses and live his life and put out these books that are incredibly celebrated and sell for millions of dollars and have, you know, a lot of laudatory shit all around them.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't have to answer for the controversies.
Mm.
Whereas, and this is different, like, we're a different generation, we're a different medium, but, you know, I stake my claim on who I am. And, you know, we stand by, Andrea and I stand by each other, and we stand by what we put out in this podcast. We want to be open and willing to have conversations. And over the years, like, if you go back to our Silence of the Lamb episode, I don't know if I recommend that, because we were babies. We were podcasting babies at that time. But it's something that, like, we've grown a lot since then. Our, you know, our core morals have, you know, I think remained the same, but we've become more educated and more worldly, and we've learned about other communities, and our language has changed. And I think that's really important, and that's something I'm really proud of. And so it just was kind of like, the more I dug into these stories overall, and we'll touch on the overall Hannibal universe again towards the end, but it really was like, shit, you don't have to answer for anything, do you, Thomas Harris?
Are you implying that that's like maybe out of cowardice, out of like that he knows that this is problematic and wrong and just doesn't want to?
You know what? I think it's because he can. And, you know, we'll talk about this more when we get into it, but the kind of, you know, socially acceptable things that were happening in the 80s and 90s that he could just write about that we are now looking back on with a more critical eye. I think it's a really tricky thing, and it's a bit sad to imagine someone who's had such an impact on culture, particularly genre culture, not be, I think, more transparent with understanding that politics have changed, or this is where I was coming from, maybe this is how it could be updated, like being a bit more of a generous creator.
Okay,
that's what I wish, and that's something that's been, you know, kind of kicking around the old cobwebs in my brain last week.
All right, well, when we disappear into our recluse era and we are no longer speaking to universities about podcasting writ large, I'll remind you.
Oh my God, I'm very excited for that era. Me but too. Until then, we remain accountable.
We read for your the emails. Yeah. We take your critiques and we put them on t-shirts. That's doing the work.
But then there's also a lot of fabulous critique, which has really, really helped us. But maybe one day. One day. But you know, because there's a lot of celebratory stuff about Harris. And I found this one article, and it's on the Penguin UK, like the publishing house Penguin, their UK site. And the article, and we'll link it in the show notes, is called How Thomas Harris Defined the Genre and Created Fiction's Most Likeable Villain. And it's by Tom Tivnan, and it was from 2019. And Tivnan's whole thing is that these novels basically stand the test of time because they are about other things, such as likable but complicated protagonists, the different killers in each one, like who is the real villain. Yet Lecter remains the through line, and you've got this kind of, according to Tivnan again, this interesting development of evil. And through this series, you're kind of always questioning, is Hannibal evil? Does the evil develop due to circumstance? And then as a reader, as an audience member, how does your perception of evil change? You know, sometimes he's really likable and he's really helpful, but other times he's, you know, really scary and really aggressive and mean. And how does that change your relationship with a character? And I don't disagree with that. But I think, like, none of this article touches on anything else.
Well, I just feel like the only issue I might take with that article is Lecter even the villain? Like, I don't think he becomes a central big bad until the film Hannibal. And in Silence of the Lambs,
Manhunter...
And even
then he's not. He's an anti-hero.
He's a reflection of Will Graham in that he's mostly bad, but he has aspects that make him helpful. And I feel like Will Graham is the flip side of that in that he's mostly good, but he has traits of psychopathy, or he suspects he does. Like, this is, again, like further developed later down the line, and especially in the TV show. But fundamentally, Lecter presents this cipher for the actual villain, Francis Dolarhyde. And, you know, in terms of likability, look, Francis Dolarhyde is an absolute monster, but I couldn't help but feel, and I remembered upon rewatching the film feeling this when I read Red Dragon, that I was rooting for him and Reba. I was thinking, maybe he could beat this. Maybe the love of a good woman is all this abused motherfucker needs, which of course isn't the case, but that did reach me on some level. Did it reach you?
Yeah, I think we'll talk a lot about Dolarhyde, but I think there is a very interesting portrayal by Tom Noonan.
I think Thomas Harris plants seeds of redeemability, which is what makes his monsters, if not likable, relatable.
Yeah. Because we want to see some of ourselves in them, and then seeing ourselves within a character scares us when it's a character who is the antagonist, who's going to kill us. But one more important thing to talk about with Thomas Harris, the man, is that he didn't start out as a novelist.
No, I love this. I
saw that he started out as a journalist. He covered the police beat in the Waco Tribune Herald, and this was well before Waco was put on the map for its really interesting history with police and the FBI and all of that. But, you know, the character of Freddie Lowndes, the institution of journalism vis-a-vis the FBI, vis-a-vis the local police, like all of that complicated stuff likely came from him working that beat.
Yeah, and it seems like Harris got a lot of inspiration. He started meeting people and talking to cops and getting a whole sense of what this world is like. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to inspire all of his novels. So with that being said, let's talk a little bit about the importance of tabloids and true crime.
Yes. Now, this was something that I was just kind of like, granted, I don't really follow the news, but I almost wonder, I have to assume that American journalism is a little bit maybe more sensate. Like the Freddie Lowndes character, I could not relate to. He's archetypal. He's a bottom feeder. He's a night crawler. He's, you know, a co-villain. But I was also like, I can't think of a real life counterpart to that guy.
Well, I mean, tabloids are really interesting, and I'll get into some of the more specifics in a second. But when we start to think about tabloids, they really started in the UK. And, you know, I think from celebrities to public figures will always tell you the UK tabloids are worse. They are more vicious. They tap phones. They do all of this illegal shit to sell their papers. Mm-hmm. They, you know, you can argue there was a hand in Princess Diana's death. You know, all of this stuff, and it kind of moves through Europe that way.
We talked about this in our Jack the Ripper episode,
yeah,
about how it was kind of written to be a salve for the masses. It was written to, like, appease a very anxious and newly literate poor.
Exactly. And how do you make something like this accessible? So there is a fantastic article all about this in Time magazine that we'll link in the show notes, called "The Tabloid That Launched America's Obsession with True Crime" by Joe Pompeo. So this whole article is worth a read, but to give you the highlights. At the start of the 20th century, there was the London Daily Mirror. The Daily Mirror was a more compact version of the typical newspaper broadsheets. You know, that big thing you fold over. This was something you could hold in your hand, and it was a very straightforward version of the news. And it had an emphasis on salacious stories for the middle and working class. This was also around the time of the rise of photography. You could tell a lot of information or grab attention with a really salacious photo. And, you know, as we've already alluded to, and I think probably talked about on this show, when you pander to the middle and the working class, what does that do? It distracts, it entertains, and there is a time and a place for all of that. Listen, I am deep into the Kate Middleton conspiracy theory realm right
really?
Now. Oh, deep. Deep.
Okay.
In.
I didn't even know there was a thing.
Oh my God.
You have a whole life I don't know about.
I know.
Sometimes.
Okay. I'm going to tell you off mic,
okay,
but it is fascinating. And maybe by the time this episode comes out, we'll know what happened to her.
Is she a lizard person?
Anyway. So clearly it still works on some of us. And the idea of keeping, you know, this working middle class distracted and not reading the more quote unquote dense, important news, what do you lose? You lose political activity. You lose people becoming more involved in the community, potentially.
Mm.
You're just kind of relying on like, ooh, look at the scandalous thing that I can kind of gossip about.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I love that shit. There is a time and a place for it. But getting back to the article, Joseph Medhill Patterson and Colonel R. McCormick brought the format over to the States. They envisioned a tabloid that was half photos, half news stories with plain writing, funny writing. It was going to have gossip about the rich and about crime. And it was all designed to keep the reader's attention in the face of the emerging mediums of movies and radio. This created the Daily News, which launched in 1919. It had an initial burst of popularity, but then it crashed for a little bit. But then in the early years of the 1920s, it suddenly rose again. And Pompeo attributes this to America getting through World War I, the flu pandemic, and they'd been surrounded by death and destruction, and the news was just hard to fucking take. So they wanted to read about organized crime and like the murder down the street or, you know, the rich people gossip or the sex scandal that happened to a politician. So he really delves into some of these early true crime beats that they were covering, and they would cover them with photography. And again, really plain, easy to understand language that would get people kind of riled up and talking. Mm-hmm. And so from there, you know, tabloids have really become a staple of the American and international news market, and it paved the way for true crime and even celebrity gossip culture, which both still exist today. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they've moved into other and new mediums. And at this point, when we think of the tabloid in the 1920s, you know, crime was not just a densely reported on article with a lot of names and places and like police details. It was sensationalized. It was coming to life. You were hearing the story. You were hearing how someone died and who could be involved, and like it would rile up the public in a way that traditional news couldn't. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I certainly remember, you know, growing up, and it was, you know, you're at the grocery store with your folks, and there was the tabloids right by the cashier. Mm-hmm. And you could just get a whole story from the covers.
Yeah,
we didn't have to read them. We knew everything based on those covers. And it was, you know, it's an incredibly fascinating piece of media to consume.
Yeah, they were designed to do that. When you hear about front page news, when you hear about above the fold, like that all harkens back to classic journalism where at a glance you get a taste.
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. Like it makes me think about how, you know, Toronto had that rash of murders, and I felt like I was kind of following it, but like I couldn't tell you who our DA was, who our police chief is, you know? Mm-hmm. I think the idea of these figures being very present in civil discourse, the idea of a cover story having a picture of Will Graham being like, here he is with star correspondent Freddie Lowndes on the case, is something that I feel doesn't apply to right now.
Well, and it's Freddie Lowndes is such a fascinating character within the story of Red Dragon, but also within Manhunter.
Yeah.
And he's utilized in the same way in both, pretty much. And really, it starts with like Will Graham hating him.
Yeah.
Because Freddie Lowndes snapped photos of him while he was in the hospital recovering from like some brutal injuries that Lecter gave him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's really pissed off.
So, hey, Lowndes, why don't you give it a rest?
Hey, he's news. I'm doing my job.
So, how does this guy compare with Lecter? Huh? What does he do to him? How's he doing? How's he doing, Will?
Keep the fuck away from me.
Will. Will.
And then they realize they can use him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, like, he's got this role of, like, invader of privacy, like a nightcrawler, like yeah. I said. And the fact that they're able to use him and then goes horribly awry, which, you know, as if Will Graham isn't tortured enough.
And it goes wrong in the, like, inverse way that they planned. Because mm-hmm. they're thinking they're going to draw out the Tooth Fairy, a.k.a. the Red Dragon, in pursuit of Will, when actually he goes after Lowndes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting. When the film came out, it didn't do well at the box office. It didn't do well critically. A lot of this was lumped on Mann and his visual style and kind of mocking the, like, oversaturated neon tones of it and all of that. And I don't know about you, Andrea, but I love the visual style of this film. It's like you could pause it at any moment and it would be like something you could put in a gallery. Like they're stunningly beautiful images.
I can't say I entirely noticed. I did notice that when Will Graham is visiting Hannibal Lecter in the cell, I found that was a very striking image and really beautifully staged. And like I said before, if we're positing that they are two sides of the same yeah. coin, I thought that was really beautifully represented.
And I think like that to me speaks a lot to the culture of the time mm-hmm. because Mann as a filmmaker fetishizes this visual style, but he's always complicating the characters. And these characters are very usually kind of plain, normal people who have to work in crime or in something else to make things happen for themselves. Mm-hmm. They aren't just, you know, sitting on a yacht somewhere. There is real fucking stakes for them. So this kind of duality of this luscious, intriguing visual style and these characters who are white knuckling through their lives, I find to be really interesting. I think it also informs how Dollarhide feels this kind of presence of being looked at. Mm-hmm. And like this film is all about being looked at.
Yeah.
And the way Dollarhide hides and then he comes forward and like he's changing, he is becoming something different.
And he wants that to be witnessed. That's his entire thing. And I will say that having seen Manhunter again, and then I watched Red Dragon pretty much right after. I do feel like Manhunter is the vastly superior film, but it does have a bit of a pacing slump. Did you not think?
No, perfect movie.
Okay, all right. I felt like there were times where, like, the momentum was maybe lagging, but I do feel like it was in service to the story because there is a lot of exposition, and I appreciate that. It is a pretty satisfying mystery, the way Will Graham cracks the case and how it goes beat for beat in his realizations, and, you son of a bitch!
I mean, and I really, like, William Peterson fucking gives it.
Oh, he sure does. He gives it his everything. In his little 80s short shorts.
Oh, at the end of the film when he's like looking into the sunset with his like tiny pink shorts on.
Yeah.
I love that.
And pink flowy shorts.
That's the masculinity I adore.
Yeah, can we bring that back?
Please.
So Alex explained the reason why the title of this film is Manhunter and not Red Dragon, but I do feel like the title really does suggest who it is we're supposed to be looking at, who it is this main protagonist is, who Thomas Harris's fascination is with, and indeed Michael Mann's as well. And I feel like the character of Will Graham and the idea of the Manhunter, the fascination with the person who cracks these cases through unconventional means, has its roots way, way back in the police procedural, which itself has its roots all the way back to the mid-1880s. Again, we talked about this at length when we talked about Scotland Yard and Jack the Ripper in a prior episode. But Sherlock Holmes, Miss Marple, Hercule Poirot. My dad was Hercule Poirot for Halloween one year, and I'll never forget that mental image. It was great. Anyway, these were like detectives and others working outside of law enforcement sometimes. And, you know, this was kind of like early true crime-ness, how like people ate it up. Like, and crack the case and solve the mystery. The term itself, police procedural, was coined in 1956 by a New York Times book reviewer who noted the rise in popularity of crime fiction, where the main emphasis was in the so-called realistic depiction of police work. And specifically, he credited the success of the radio show Dragnet as a linchpin. So in looking a little bit deeper at Dragnet, Dragnet was something that I used to watch a show called Square One that had like a spoof of Dragnet, and they called it Math. It was like a kids' educational show, and it was all about these like hard-boiled detectives who, we're gonna have to use trigonometry here, I think. Do you remember that?
No.
Okay. But it led me to a fantastic article that really got my wheels turning from Vox that was published back in 2021. And it was called How 70 Years of Cop Shows Taught Us to Valorize the Police by Constance Grady. And I was like, ooh, I can already tell this is going to bleed. And, you know, like the first line of the article, early Hollywood treated the cops as incompetent fools, and then everything changed. And so the article lists all this film material of the early 1900s that depicted police as bumbling buffoons to be mocked in advertising and cartoons. Like, you know, this is really, really early cinema, but it was like, it was an archetype that was a clown, basically. And the article argues that the modern police procedural is partially the result of Hollywood needing to play nice with the police to escape police censorship, for example, to ease the application of shooting permits, for example. And Dragnet, in particular, consulted with the LAPD. The showrunner, Jack Webb, would send them his scripts, and they would have the power to veto any depiction that they considered unfavorable to the department's image. Now, this article was published in 2021. I don't know if it was originally published and then amended, but the author does reflect on how the violence of George Floyd's 2020 murder brought the subject of police brutality to the forefront and how that affected the police procedural, because it's a subgenre that hasn't lost steam over these years. And there was some really interesting discussion of a show that I've never seen. Did you watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine?
My waxing place plays Brooklyn Nine-Nine. So I have a really strange relationship.
Yes, you have like a knee-jerk reaction, yep. Literally.
Yep. So I have seen it, Andrea. Go on.
So my understanding, just from the fucking posters, just from the shot of fucking what's-his-nuts in a uniform, I feel like these are kind of bumbling cops who maybe joined the police force to be heroes, but in fact they're idiots, kind of a super troopers sort of vibe. Anyway.
But they kind of get the job done.
Okay.
And they're all buds.
They're good guys for the most part?
Like they're good people who are funny buds together. Well, it's very like the like kind of an office kind of ethos.
Got it.
Yeah.
So the writers were really grappling with the idea of using police for laughs at such a heated moment in 2020. And apparently they rewrote several unproduced episodes. And one of the actors in the series, Stephanie Beatrice, publicly donated bail relief funds for Black Lives Matter protesters as an act of restitution, being like, here we are glamoring police officers. It's uncool. We know it. We're addressing it. Anyway, overall, the thrust of this article is that the police procedural was, in part, built by the police to protect their image. And so when we see, you know, a lot of material glamorizing the police, they're just good guys doing their job, just all in a day's work, lady, blam, 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 blam. And then we take it back to Manhunter. And we've also we've talked about heroes and anti-heroes, I think, back in the Evil Dead episode. I can see those threads in Manhunter as like an extension, a complication, but extension of that good, virtuous, good guy cop narrative taken even further. Like, cops put their lives on the line every single day. But here's Will Graham, who not only risks his life and that of his family, but his own sanity is at stake. Hero, 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 how much more can one person give? And, you know, insofar as I think Manhunter tackles this issue delicately enough that it doesn't feel like pro-police propaganda, I do still feel those threads in there.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair. I think that's something all films that deal with cops and stuff, we're always going to look at now, especially as we become more aware of these issues, with I think a good amount of, you know, critical thinking, as we should do with every piece of media we consume. Mm-hmm. I think Manhunter is quite interesting because it represents several layers of cops. Mm-hmm. Like the kind of
the grunt at the desk,
yeah, like
the
they're kind of incompetent,
yeah,
they're kind like the grunts are kind of incompetent, or like there's some that make fun of it, or like they're labeling Dollar Hyde the Tooth Fairy, and but Crawford's a stand-up guy, and Will Graham is this savant, this
yes.
like untouchable savant who, because he was too invested, because he got too fucking close,
yeah,
he had to walk away.
That's right.
And then he got brought back in.
Pulled out of retirement.
One more job.
You're the only guy who can do this, Will Graham. Think of these families. Look at these photos.
Put on some full-length pants and get back in the game.
Just for a minute, though. We want those puffy shorts back at the
oh
end.
Oh, my God, those gams.
Now, I found out that Will Graham was based, at least in part, on a figure named John E. Douglas, and Mindhunter heads, not Manhunter, the, I don't know, the best Netflix series I've ever seen.
It's
still
great.
Probably one of my favorite shows to date. But that TV show was based on a book called Mindhunter. It was based on a book published in 1995 by John E. Douglas and someone else. And John E. Douglas is, you know, the Holden what's-his-name character. I really should have written it down. But he's also very much the inspiration for Will Graham, someone who is a little bit socially awkward, definitely very gifted, definitely very benevolent and stubborn and, I don't know, awkward. So Douglas's book, as I said, wasn't published till 1995. So I guess it's likely that Thomas Harris had heard of him from working on the police beat long before. And Mindhunter is still a police procedural, and it still features this young FBI agent who's so gifted at profiling, but at the expense of his social skills. He suffered panic attacks after studying Ed Kemper. And the show focuses on the emergence of the entire field of forensic profiling, and indeed what it took to make it an official division of the FBI. And so, you know, if you were thinking that Mindhunter was just like another true crime series, I would really argue that it's not. There's a lot of sociology, there's a lot of history, there's some interpersonal drama to just keep it interesting. It's great. And why is it great? I credit the presence of one Fincher of Zodiac and Seven fame. Did we do an episode episode on Seven or just Zodiac?
Both.
We've done both.
Yes, well, we've done both. Look at us.
Fincher stands. And so, like, the focus on institutions in that show brings fresh conflict into this old, cold case and subject. And I feel like Manhunter really walked so that Mindhunter could run.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of, you know, the procedural stuff that was becoming mainstream in Manhunter, but it also introduces a lot of complications to it. Mm-hmm. The systems that are not working, the bureaucracy, all the stuff that is present within Harris's novel, but Mann translated, I think, in a really smart way, and I you know, think that has a lot to do with his own personal relationship with the police force and understanding the barriers that they were facing and how bureaucracy gets in the way and how some cops are good guys and some are bad. And what does that mean for a system that is meant to protect everyone?
Well, that's right. And this series premiered in 2019. Isn't it a very dicey time for people's relations with police? And, like, I think the idea that police reform is even possible, if you look at the discourse now where it's like, defund the police, fix this. We are identifying that something is wrong, fucking fix it. And it's turning out to be very, very resistant to change. And I feel like this show kind of really illustrated the internal dynamics that make it so difficult to change. But anyway, we're going to talk further about the whole franchise and this other, like, this pantheon of serial killers in the Harrisverse. But essentially, the FBI was concerned that serial killers are something different and need to be treated differently. And they require, like, a psychological inquiry that people who are trained to be police officers don't necessarily have.
Yeah, they just have multi-million-dollar weapons.
Yes, exactly. And that's not going to do it if you don't know where he strikes next.
Actually, it doesn't do much for anyone. But
no,
continue.
I'll agree with that. I have this... I was reading up on serial killer ideology, and it's just like...
Just a regular Tuesday night for Andrea.
We remain obsessed with trying to understand the criminal mind, but all of the data is so fucking iffy. You know, like, I was reading all this stuff about lots of childhood trauma reported, like way higher rates of childhood trauma reported versus the general population. But the sociologist in me is inclined to think that child abuse, especially child sexual abuse, is vastly underreported in the general population. And, like, if we correlate criminality with abuse or trauma, then holy shit, are we in a bunch of trouble. I did find a quote from FBI profiler Jim Clemente. I don't know who the fuck he is. I don't know if he's a person of consequence, but I have to read this quote in what I imagine his voice sounds like.
Go for it.
Genetics loads the gun. Their personality and psychology aim it, and their experiences pull the trigger.
That is exactly what someone like that would sound like.
Right? Like using a metaphor of a gun? For real? Anyway, I'm not in a position to say that it's gotten better or worse. It's interesting that there was such turmoil at the idea of understanding the criminal mind from a viewpoint of psychology, socioeconomics, like considering all of this. But the fact that that happened so many years ago and we're still in such bad shape is demoralizing, to say the least.
Well, and serial killers are such a fascinating creature. They have these public personas. They have these identities. They become known for how they kill. You can say Dahmer, and it conjures a litany of images. But what's really interesting to me about Dolarhyde is he is a character of various fractured personalities. Mm-hmm. He is Francis Dolarhyde on one hand, lab technician who is beginning to date his colleague who happens to be blind, but he's also a serial killer on the side. And even that identity is split between being labeled the Tooth Fairy, but then his own true believed identity of the Red Dragon. Now, the Red Dragon comes from William Blake. William Blake was both a poet and a painter. You can have it all, everyone. He did a series about this Red Dragon, and the one that's referenced the most often within the Harris novel and the films of this book is The Great Red Dragon and the Woman Clothed in the Sun. And that was done in 1805. And the basic description of this painting, and it's quite a stunning painting, is that the dragon is Satan, and it's a very muscular depiction of Satan.
It is like an entire six pack.
Yeah. Six pack upon six pack. Mm-hmm. Those are like Hemsworth muscles. Mm. But this dragon as Satan is exacting revenge on a woman who has given birth to a child who will follow the Christian faith.
Okay.
So it you know, came about 1805, where at the time where obviously religion and Christianity, as it seems to always be, is, you know, a big deal, but also so is the Enlightenment, and so is science, and so is reason. And so there's a lot of, you know, interesting writing about the Red Dragon, but I feel like Harris is really interested, and by extension, man, actually, you know what, less so man, because I think this story features less of the William Blakeness of it. We'll talk about the Brett Ratner version later on, but this idea of this kind of powerful, masculine, muscular figure that is going to destroy mothers, which is, you know, very much, when you boil it down, the MO of the Red Dragon, of the Tooth Fairy, of Francis Dolarhyde, however you want to label him. There is a really interesting article that goes into a reading of the use of William Blake in Red Dragon, and it's called Eating Blake, or An Essay on Taste, The Case of Thomas Harris's Red Dragon by Nicholas M. Williams. We'll link it in the show notes because the whole thing is really interesting. But one of the things I really distilled from this article was that there's an interesting distinction between the populism of the titillating crime thriller paperback mixed with the high art of Blake. Mm. And what does it mean? Because in the novel, Dolarhyde actually goes to the Brooklyn Museum, where the painting is, goes to see it because it's hidden behind, like, it's kept in a private space, and you have to request to go see it. And he actually eats it.
Yeah, it's in the Ratner version.
Yeah, we'll get to that. But I love this idea of, like, what are we doing when we consume high art through mass art?
Yeah.
That, I just wanted to say, fascinating article. Really interested in it.
It is really interesting. It makes me think of the Da Vinci Code as well.
You were having a real moment with that.
I was having a moment with that. I watched it. I think it was New Year's Eve. And I was like, this is hilarious. Like, it's terrible, but it's delightful. And then I watched the sequel and I was like, oh, this is just really hard to watch and boring and unsatisfying. But I wonder if there's an aspect of, you know, insofar as we were talking about tabloids being fodder for the masses, like, do you think it's a little bit of, oh no, we're elevated, we're smart, we're psychological,
I feel artsy. Like there is a veneer to Harris's writing that feels classy, but everything else is kind of trashy.
Yeah, which is like the character of Hannibal Lecter in a nutshell, right? Like
exactly.
The most civilized person culturally doing the most quote-unquote savage behavior possible.
Yeah, and trying to reconcile those dualities, which is all like what this film is about, the duality of man.
Okay.
But what I thought was really interesting, and I want to talk about this, because in Manhunter, so much of Dolarhyde's backstory is omitted. Mm. We are just left with a monster who is struggling. And I think this speaks to the talent of both Michael Mann and the actor Tom Noonan, who plays Francis Dolarhyde. And both Mann and Noonan keep with the basic premise of Dolarhyde is a loner. While he interacts with other people, he is uncomfortable because of his cleft palate and lip. So he's always trying to hide it. But the only person he becomes comfortable with is Reba, because she's very nice to him and she's also blind. So she's not catching all this stuff off the bat, even though she can hear something, you know, is happening in his voice. So she knows he's struggling with something.
She knows just what to say. Like, I know how it feels to be different. I know how it feels to be.
She can relate to him.
Yeah.
And at the same time, he is also much more confident when he feels that he is the dragon.
Right.
Like the scene with Freddie Lowndes.
Yeah.
Look at the screen. William Blake's The Great Red Dragon and the woman clothed in the rays of the sun. Do you see?
Yes.
Mrs. Leeds, do you see?
Yes.
Mrs. Jacoby, do you see?
Yes.
The next family as they will look when I go to visit them. Do you see?
Yes.
Mrs. Leeds, later. Her husband beside her.
Yes.
Mrs. Jacoby, after her changing, the dragon rampant. Freddie Lowndes, your photograph.
No.
No what?
No, not me, please.
The repetition of "Do you see? Do you see?" It's not a question, it's a statement.
Mm-hmm,
and it's chilling.
Mm-hmm.
And Noonan is so controlled in this. And I think it's so incredible because earlier on in this episode, I was mentioning the Ashley Judd moment in Heat.
Yeah.
And in this moment, it's a scene based off of, you know, also an earlier moment with Val Kilmer. And both these characters have a very complicated relationship with each other. And they convey, like, years to decade plus of relationship without words.
Mm-hmm.
It's a testament to the actors. It's a testament to the director. All of these moments hit. And in Manhunter, Michael Mann gets rid of all this backstory. I imagine, you know, there's budgetary constraints. There's all kinds of reasons to get rid of backstory. And it all cuts down to that moment when Dollar Hyde's in bed with Reba. And he just feels this moment and, like, the song crescendos and he just starts to cry.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems genuinely scared of what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so fucking powerful. And it's like, I don't need an additional 30 minutes of sad man serial killer. I understand everything about the conflict that this human being is going through
mm-hmm.
without having to hear a whole fucking la-di-da backstory about a grandmother and teeth.
Well, and because sometimes that backstory rings as making excuses. Sometimes it rings as absolving a monster of being a monster.
Cough, cough, Rob Zombie's Halloween.
For example. And, you know, it really stuck out to me when Will Graham says something to the effect of, "I weep for this young abused boy, but I'm going to get the monster he became." I think it communicates a lot of nuance in a very compact manner, as you say.
Yeah, and I think this also kind of goes back into the Freddie Lowndes of it all and why Dollar Hyde becomes fixated on Lowndes and not Graham,
mm-hmm.
because Graham is the one who said it, but Lowndes is the one who put it out there.
Yeah.
Lowndes is the one who has the access, and we know the National Tattler is important to Dollar Hyde because that's how he uses to communicate with Hannibal Lecter, and he sees Hannibal Lecter as very important, so if Hannibal Lecter is getting this, how will he be perceived? Like, there's a whole litany of perception. And, you know, the notion of calling Tooth Fairy, and that's like a homophobic thing to draw him out.
Yes.
Is a very complex thing. And again, as we are in the 1980s, you know, in the novel and then in this version of the film, it's a very media saturated environment, which is only becoming more so. So you are trading on your perception of who you are, you know. Cool for Thomas Harris not to worry about that, but Francis Dollar Hyde does.
Well, and I wonder if that factors into it, like for his villain to be so obsessed with being seen and controlling how he is seen to criminal effect. Maybe that's a preoccupation that Harris shares.
Well, and Francis Dollar Hyde very much feels that he is an outsider and or has made himself an outsider. And I think you can argue both, and I think both are probably true. But he is in a job in his film lab where he is observing families. And we're going to talk about the family home movie in just a moment. But it's a kind of strange saturation of a homogenous way to be a family and to be confronted and to have access to these families who replicate, reproduce, and record their happiness through their videos, through their children. They are reproducing what they have. There is a class system at play. And I think that's also comes to play between Lecter and Dollar Hyde. Dollar Hyde is decidedly coded and, you know, for all we know, lower class or working class, at least. In comparison to Lecter, who is a doctor, who is very well spoken, who is very articulate and very well known. And Dollar Hyde is struggling to be known as the thing he wants to be.
Yeah, I loved the way home movies factor into this plot, how they become the linchpin to solving the plot, how they mirror the whole Freddie Lowndes thing where, like, this is recorded, but it's private. And if it becomes public or viewed by the wrong person, that's not okay because privacy is important. It all just works so beautifully.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's an interesting thing to think about how we record ourselves. obviously we've had, you know, I think in the last 10 plus years, a discussion about how we portray ourselves on social media.
Yes.
Before that, you know, we're dealing with things like home movies and elements that this film is very cognizant, and as is the book, to put it right in front of us the whole fucking time.
Yeah.
The whole time. Like, and I think Michael Mann does a great job at this, of just having these films on repeat and repeat and repeat, and Will's just watching them. And it's only at the very end, when it's like push comes to shove, does he realize this is the key.
Uh-huh. I mean, I will say that I felt like the home movies in Manhunter looked very edited. They definitely didn't seem as authentically amateur as they do in Ratner's remake.
Well, let's talk about that. I found a really interesting article. We'll link in the show notes. And it's called Hollywood Home Movies and Common Sense: Amateur Films as Aesthetic Dissemination and Social Control, by Patricia R. Zimmerman. And this is from the Cinema Journal in the summer of 1988. Now, again, this is another fascinating article. If you're interested in this topic, I highly recommend reading the whole thing. But here are some of the highlights as they apply, in my opinion, to Manhunter. So family home movies really started to become a thing in the 1950s as a suburban family pastime. As leisure time rose and families moved out of cities and invested in homes that they purchased, they were more predisposed to wanting to record their activities. They'd invested all this time and money and energy in these houses, so why not show how happy you are there? Now, Zimmerman goes on to say that as leisure time became a regular part of life, so did the need to idealize it. These nuclear families were, in a sense, self-marketing their lives to themselves. As film grew as a medium in popular culture, it also influenced affluent families who had homes, camera equipment, and leisure time to document themselves in a similar manner. So you see much more of like, ooh, let's frame this shot like that. There's, you know, a lot of stuff about, you know, major filmmakers who are like, yeah, I had my Super 8 as a kid, and yeah, I was just went out back to shoot a movie. Mm-hmm. So they're utilizing home technology to mimic something that they're seeing on a big scale.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And how do they do that? So
we're the stars of our own movie.
Exactly. And we talk a lot about, you know, on Instagram, for instance, you know, you are presenting one version of your life. You're not showing the boring, you're not showing the ugly, you're not showing this, that, or the, or you are, and that's a real choice to
mm-hmm,
do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can make a similar argument for these home movies. You are presenting a very distinct part of your life. We didn't have home movies in my family, but I can tell you, we don't have photos of my parents fighting.
Well, yeah.
We have photos of us in a nice family gathering.
Yeah.
You know, and
there was a nice moment. That's what you want to capture.
Yes.
I think that that was maybe more subconscious back in that day than it is now with the gram. A little less curated, I'm inclined to think.
Well, and also if we look at now, we all, maybe not all, but a lot of us, certainly a lot more of us, have a pretty good camera that's, you know, still and video in our hands or nearby at most times. Mm-hmm. So not only has it gone to you can curate your identity, but to go back to the idea of the police, you can also record what the police do to you as they record you.
Yes.
So there are layers to our what we present of ourselves and what we capture and what we hold on to and mm-hmm. what is evidence and what is not. It's really
who it belongs to, how private or public it is. Like, I often think about how Instagram stories have that 24-hour limit, but you know, we're on the subreddits for VPR. When someone posts something, it doesn't only live there for 24 hours. We're screen grabbing that shit.
Oh,
we're
yeah.
talking about it years later.
Yeah. No, nothing really disappears.
No.
And I think if we think of like Dolarhyde's fear of being seen as something to do with his disfigurement, the cleft palate and the cleft lip. While film and pictures being seen has moved into a more accessible, common place, he still fears it mm-hmm. to some degree. And to control it, he picks these idealized families that he's watching for work, that he is confronted with through his job. And he wants to make them, again, an armchair this a little bit, to make them enact his narrative. And, you know, we feel these inferred effects as they talk about the mirror shards being used on the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that is a very visceral description of what's being done to
yeah.
these people.
Horrific. Yeah.
However, One of the most chilling, if not the most chilling moment in the film is when Graham actually slips into the fantasy. And it's the, you know, it's the one of the matriarchs when the mother's like reclining on the bed and her eyes and her mouth are all lit up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like chilling because that's what Dolly Hyde sees.
I know. It's such shoddy special effects, but you get it. And you're
it's so effective mm-hmm. to me. Like it's so, again, it's two women on the internet. We have dealt with things. And so I think it was slipping into what someone who's maybe not super stable views their violence as
mm-hmm.
and how beautiful and sexualized it can be.
That's right.
Chilling.
You hear that guy who keeps slipping into my DMs asking me to step on you? I'm not going to step on you. It's not happening.
Please stop
asking.
So where Dolly Hyde really gets his control of this narrative is in these intimate settings with the family as he's brutalizing them. That's where he truly gets to reveal himself as the dragon. That's what we are certainly led to infer. That's what we are led to believe. We only get that taste of it with the Freddy Lounge scene as he's kind of torturing him and showing him the slideshow. So I think Dolly Hyde really masks his fear of being seen by infiltrating these families
mm-hmm.
and creating his own narratives and creating his own ways of being seen and his own narratives. And as this narrative becomes uncontrollable as soon as like the media gets a hold of it, as soon as like the FBI is trying to figure him out, it all gets away from Dolly Hyde
mm-hmm.
at that point. It becomes open to interpretation. It becomes open to influence. And so that's when everything kind of goes off the rails for him.
Yeah. It's a complex, tangled thing. And actually in that, in retrospect, when you look at, you know, we've already talked about how cop figures can be very two-dimensional in modern media. So can villains.
Mm-hmm.
They're just bad. They're just horny. They just love their mom. They just hate their mom. Like, there's a lot going on with Frances Dolly Hyde.
Yeah.
So there is a lot going on with Frances Dolly Hyde. There is a lot of, you know, it's insofar as I find him a really compelling character. I find it a really compelling mystery, both in how it exists and how it's solved and all of that. I also can't help but think that Thomas Harris kind of like Googled the word taboo. Found all these examples.
Back in 1980, whatever.
Yeah, you know, he went to the library and, like, the analog Googled it. and was just kind of like, cannibalism? Got it. Incest? Okay. Like, I will just incorporate all the most fucked up shit I can think of and throw it all into this salad and throw it all together. And, of course, I think there's some pop culture psychology in there, too. I was looking at how Freud viewed criminality specifically with regard to homosexuality. And we're going to talk about this a little more, that, you know, homophobic slurs are thrown around in this film, mostly as a baiting technique, mostly as a, I feel like almost a device to be like, yeah, it's the 80s and 90s, and we're deeply homophobic. And look, I was in high school. I remember when the absolute worst thing you could call someone was a homophobic slur. For chicks, maybe it was slut, which I would maybe laugh at now. And, you know, I don't know what kids in high school are going through today. But anyway, back to Freud. Homosexuality to him was as simple as an inverted Oedipus complex. Boys identifying with mom instead of dad makes them then want to fuck men instead of women. And I think that that's something that's kind of not overtly touched upon in the film, but it's like, is this what's going on? Is it as simple as that?
Good old Freud.
Good old
Freud,
right?
He can always let you down.
But I actually think that the armchair psychology that we see in Manhunter is more closely aligned with Freud's contemporary in Havelock Ellis. He published a book called Sexual Inversion with John Addington Symonds in 1896. It was translated into English the following year, and it was banned in England as being lewd and scandalous because it was progressive for its time. It refused to criminalize or pathologize homosexual acts or emotions or anything that could be construed of that nature. Now, he agreed with Freud that all humans were born sexually indiscriminate and that we slowly narrow down our preferences and choose which sex act to stick with. And he did suspect that those who went down that path likely had strong feelings of inadequacy, fear of failure, and possibly fear of the opposite sex. And if that's not word for word from this fucking script, I don't know what it is. But Ellis himself insisted that homosexuality was innate. First of all, innate, that we all have the capacity for it within us, and harmless in itself, which was why it was so controversial when it first came out. And so, you know, when it comes to the discourses around homophobia, around Manhunter, around Red Dragon, I feel like we have to ask ourselves, like, we have problematized Silence of the Lambs already. We have problematized pop culture depictions of homosexuality as lecherous, deviant, criminal, medicalized, insane, and all that stuff before. But as always, at the end of the day, when it comes to evaluating whether this is a reflection of the reality, of the pop culture reality that is deeply homophobic and is deeply distrustful of police and, or is it in itself contributing to the language of homophobia? Is it weaponizing homophobia? We have to look at where the finger points.
Yeah, you know, within Thomas Harris's work, mm-hmm. especially within the Hannibal Lecter verse, mm-hmm. it's hard not to see all these like big spikes in homophobic elements within most of the stories.
Yeah.
In Red Dragon and Manhunter, you've got the kind of use of homophobia to draw Dollar Hyde out, which, you know, you kind of see people snicker at, like Dennis Farina's Jack Crawford kind of snickers at it, and he's kind of like, bleh. And it works.
Yeah.
It works. The Brett Ratner version goes a bit more full on with that. A
couple of F-bombs in there, as I recall.
Yes, those F-slurs are real, not necessary, but they are there. And then, of course, I don't think we need to go into the fucking minefield that Silence of the Lambs is.
We have already.
We attempted it.
Yeah.
And now I think with even more scholarship behind it in the last 11 years since we did that episode.
It's there. Go find it.
There are so many like smarter, better people who talk about
members
this
of
than
that
us
community. Yeah,
that are doing mm-hmm. such great work on that. So we leave it to them. But I think we all kind of know. While Silence of the Lambs is, you know, important piece of literature, a great film, it has really deeply problematic elements. Mm-hmm. And then we come to Hannibal.
Yo. I tried to rewatch it. I tried to rewatch all of these films as I was playing a video game, had it going on in the background, see if it informed anything I wanted to talk about vis-a-vis Manhunter. And let me tell you, in any other context, I would have just turned it off. And insofar as I feel like I'm not desensitized, not accepting, but like, you know, I've watched movies that haven't aged well, you know, and you're just kind of like, that was a popular slur at the time. That was reflective of the rhetoric and that's problematic. That film felt to me deeply hateful.
Yeah. And I was like,
toxic and mean-spirited.
Well, it was co-written by David Mamet, a very important playwright who was all about like toxic masculinity and
cool.
was a real shit show of a person.
Great.
I also rewatched Hannibal in the couple weeks we had in prep for this episode, and I hadn't seen that film in a long fucking time, and I've forgotten most of it. I kind of remembered the Anthony Hopkins eating Ray Liotta's brain.
Yeah.
I knew Julianne Moore plays Clarice Starling.
Yeah.
And beyond that, I was like, oh yeah, and Gary Oldman's in a lot of makeup.
Yeah.
But holy shit. I mean, from the opening sequence where Clarice Starling is on assignment to catch a female gang leader.
Yeah.
But this female gang leader is HIV positive, and Clarice Starling has this whole thing about like, you have to be careful because she'll bite and she'll spit and she'll, you know,
she'll weaponize her AIDS. And what follows is just all these white cops gunning down. Like, that film aged like milk.
I was watching that section. I completely forgotten about it. And I was watching that section like through my fingers.
Yeah.
Like it was fucking 29 Palms.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
like, I couldn't believe what was in mainstream popular cinema in 2001.
Yeah. And I think that's just it, is that I feel like it hasn't gone down in history as like, I don't believe it was well received. I don't like, I think it was kind of a big decline for this series that obviously peaked with Silence of the Lambs fucking cleaning up at the Oscars. It remains like a preeminent
cultural
example
touchstone.
Of, that's right. Of like horror can do really well and it changed the game and we can't take that away from it, but holy shit.
It's so fucked up. And then it goes, and that's just the first like 10 minutes of the film. And then you get on into the character of Mason Verger, who in the Ridley Scott, this 2001 film that Sir Ridley Scott directed, played by Gary Oldman. And you see he is like a victim of Hannibal Lecter, who cut himself up. So he's all like under a shit ton of makeup.
After hitting on Hannibal Lecter, and
then you get a flashback where, because Mason Verger is very clearly labeled a pedophile consistently throughout the film. And then he says in his own words that he was trying to seduce Hannibal Lecter very deeply and clearly queer coding him throughout the film, which again labels, it's incredibly harmful. Like, it's incredibly harmful, incredibly toxic. And like, what the fuck?
Big what the fuck?
What the fuck? I think for so many of us, we've only been like really focused on The Silence of the Lambs. Like, hey, great movie, problematic element. How do we deal with this?
Yeah.
Great conversation to have. We're still having it. Again, as we said, working on it. People smarter and better than us are working on it. But then we've got this kind of like nascent element in Red Dragon / Manhunter. And then it becomes fully fucking realized in Hannibal.
Yeah.
And it is so dark and it is so fucked up. And I kind of attribute it to this, you know, Thomas Harris being of a certain age and the kind of casual homophobia that was generally accepted in the 80s and 90s. But when you are Thomas Harris, writer of one of the most iconic literary characters in the late 20th century, I question the responsibility you have. And this is where I get touchy about the recluseness of it all. You get to hide away. You get to go live in wherever the fuck you live, in your home that you probably own outright. And you don't have to answer to anyone. You don't have to deal with like, hey, this is really harmful. And it perpetuates stereotypes and it perpetuates problems that marginalized communities are still fucking dealing with.
Yeah.
And I hate that.
Yeah. How much better would you hear if he turned around and said, oh, I'm sorry?
I would feel fucking better about it.
I don't know. Look, and I'm not giving him a pass in any way, shape, or form. What my impression of his career, given that he only wrote a handful of these films, given what we know about Hannibal Rising that I think we were about to get to, and I don't mean to steal your thunder, but I think he hit on some really great shit and everybody wanted more. And it was a case of A, the classic diminishing returns of the sequel, and B, a sense of, well, what worked about Red Dragon? Was it all the psychosexual stuff? It was. Let's amplify. So many horror-specific series do this, is they have a wrong idea of like, oh, well, what everybody loved about Child's Play was Chucky, so let's put Chucky right, like, front and forward. Freddy Krueger, like, everybody does this. I think there's a little bit of that as well. Sure. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I just think it's really disappointing, and when you look at the kind of totality of it all, it's like, this is a problem inherent to the text. And I kind of understand, like, you know, I don't want to say I give them a pass, but I understand the Michael Mann and Jonathan Demme just being like, okay, this is part of it. We'll just incorporate it and whatever. And as you get further along in time, I have a harder time excusing these elements.
Sure. No, nor should you. I guess I just feel like, you know, we always talk about separating the art from the artist and like a sorry from him, a mea culpa from him. I don't know how much that would change the way I feel about
it. I think the best mea culpa for this whole series is Brian Fuller's Hannibal.
You're right. That was a big, bright, beautiful tablecloth to throw over this whole mess and to recast it and correct, right its wrongs and modernize it and update it. You're absolutely right.
And I'm not a fanable, but I went back and watched a couple episodes again in prep for this. And I was like, yeah, they are just kind of leaning into the weirdness of like sexuality and attraction and danger and murder. And it's like, yeah. It's weird. We are all on a goddamn spectrum of everything.
Well, speaking of spectrum, I felt like the care given to Will Graham and his torturedness and his awkwardness, it's like, no, you're neurodivergent. You're a fucking genius.
Yeah.
You are so valuable in your special skills. And, you know, that was really important, I think, the sexual dynamics. Freddie Lowndes was recast as a lady. It was fun.
And this is why I always want to be cool with things being rediscovered and reinterpreted. And like, let's just embrace some of these problematic elements and reclaim them and make them powers and you know, embrace the, like, this element of it. Yeah. So it becomes a really positive part of the story and not a negative.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, homophobia is sadly still a huge part of our reality. And insofar as we're not throwing those slurs around willy-nilly as much anymore, I hope, unless you're like playing Fortnite on the internet, you know, that change is happening. And we're always talking about, like, you don't want to be colorblind. You don't want to, like, we can't ignore that this is part of our history and that this is something that we're still struggling with.
And that's why I'm very excited about, like, different, like, showrunners and directors and writers, like, getting to tackle some of this material. So I think it's a good reminder for all of us that if something's getting remade, let's, like, hope for the best.
Give it a shot, especially if it's problematic.
Yeah. Like, it's things are open to reinterpretation.
Yeah.
And you can always resituate things. And sometimes it can be really fucking subtle, but it can make a world of difference. Mm-hmm.
That said, I don't know what it would take to get a remake of Hannibal to get me in a theater seat. It would take a Hemsworth abs. It would
take two.
Take a 12 pack.
But speaking of reinterpretations and everything, as we begin to wrap up, I just kind of wanted to touch on some of these characters.
Yeah.
Because we've already mentioned Brian Cox as Lecter. Lector.
Lector.
I, we all know this. I love Brian Cox. Like, Autopsy of Jane Doe. Like, the man can do anything. His autobiography is a fucking delight. If you haven't read it or listened to the audiobook, which he narrates, highly, highly, highly recommend. A goddamn delight of a human being. One of the best compliments I've actually ever received in my life came from two friends of mine separately. And this is when Succession was really, really big. And these two friends of mine separately said to me, because there was that whole thing of, like, if you're into Succession, like, who are you in Succession? Mm-hmm. And I was always like, I don't know. And they were like, you're Logan Roy, which is the Brian Cox character.
Okay.
Just know that about me, that I am the Logan Roy. Anyway, I think one of the most abrasive things in Manhunter is Hannibal Lecter's setup. He is in white walls. He is on his own. He is not in this, like, basement dungeon of, like, the Baltimore Psychiatric Hospital. He is in this very, like, cool, clean, sanitized space. And the other notable element of this is he's not standing and waiting. He's got his back turned to Graham. He's, like, on his bed. And he's just like, I can fucking smell you.
That's the same atrocious aftershave you wore in court 3 years ago.
Yeah, I keep getting it for Christmas.
And to me, when I watch these scenes, there's not a lot of charm. There's not a lot of, you know, playing a game. He's not, you know, toying with anyone. It feels much more to me like a shark, like someone who's always just trying to move ahead. And that's why I think it feels very freaky to me in the scenes where Graham is, they're just sitting across from each other, but there's the bars in front of them. Because the way Cox plays it, I'm like, if those bars weren't there, he'd rip my neck out and, like, drink my blood.
I definitely had a heightened sense of malice with Brian Cox's Hannibal versus Anthony Hopkins. I feel like Anthony Hopkins tries to communicate the menace and the madness through these stares, whereas Cox's Hannibal was a lot more conversational. Yeah. He could change the conversation and direct the narrative with, like, tremendous ease. And I hate to admit it, but I think also a lot of his menace came from seeing how unsettled Will Graham was across from him, seeing him squirm, seeing how desperate he is to get out of there, seeing how affected he is by it. It just doesn't hit the same as when it's Clarice Starling getting called a rube.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, as someone who also owns cheap shoes, I feel like Hannibal Lecter would be my friend when it's played by Anthony Hopkins. However, I feel like Brian Cox as Hannibal Lecter, there's something much more vicious.
He's so observant and so casual with his madness and his genius, and he will just read you to fucking filth.
And I saw, you know, Brian Cox is a fantastic interview, as one might imagine. So I found an interview where he was talking about playing Hannibal Lecter, and he said he really based it on the real-life serial killer, Peter Manuel, who is an American-Scottish serial killer. And one of his most notable traits when he was murdering people in Scotland was that he actually did his own self-defense in trial.
Okay.
A very interesting, weird figure in the annals of true crime. But he talks about in this interview, like, that's what got to him when he was doing research and when he was thinking about the part was that it's the normality.
Mm.
When you're just kind of casual about things. And I think that allowed William Peterson, who plays Will Graham, to do a lot of work as well. And I think it's that balance between the two of them that is so powerful.
Again, it's seeing, it's the reflection, it's that which you project versus what's going on.
And two very different forms of masculinity that understand each other.
Uh-huh.
Very Michael Manny. Can we talk a little bit about Will Graham?
Of course.
Mr. Pink Shorts himself, mm-hmm. which we love.
Mm-hmm.
We fucking love
it. I love how he plays this role, and then many decades later, he plays Grissom on CSI.
Yeah.
Which is such a, like, that...
And the dad in Fear.
Yeah, yeah. And like, I feel like all these roles are indebted to a little bit of Will Graham.
No, he's a really interesting actor who's gone on to have a really interesting career. I think what's notable about Will Graham is, you know, in this portrayal, he seems to lose a little bit of himself with each killer he captures because he has an emotional, mental, and physical kind of toll that it takes on him. He connects with these killers. That's how he unravels their plans. Mm-hmm. That's how he gets at them. And Will Graham, I think, especially through the lineage that was Brian Fuller's Hannibal, has become a kind of key figure like Clarice Starling in the procedural crime thriller genre. I also think there's an element that kind of occurred to me and unfortunately occurred to me like just before you arrived. Mm-hmm. So I just noted it down. But obviously, Michael Mann's Manhunter and Jonathan Demme's The Silence of the Lambs, two very different films that deal with the kind of similar through line. But I think there's something about the way Will Graham in Manhunter moves through the world.
Okay.
It's very unimpeded, very clean. It's very sanitized. And then when Clarice Starling gets into that world, she's constantly confronted by men and it's constantly like closed off to her. And so, but even within both of them, they feel suffocated.
Yeah.
And like, there's that scene where he runs out from his first encounter with Hannibal. I love this shot where like the grass is out of focus
mm-hmm.
and then it slowly goes into focus and you realize, oh, that was his point of view.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's really smart and really simple and really effective. And you get to feel like, despite Will Graham having all of this kind of freedom and access as a cis white male, mm-hmm. he is still deeply, deeply impacted by everything that is happening to him.
Mm-hmm.
And Clarice Starling, while she is, you know, the newbie on the job, she's the rookie, she is constantly being impeded by people's assumptions of her. And so she's closed in a very different way.
Mm-hmm. And like, indeed, under the shadow of Will Graham, under like what everyone knows Hannibal did to him, mm-hmm. if he could do that to him, what's he going to do to me?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also made note of Will Graham as a paternal figure with regard to masculinity with his little spiel with his son. It's his son in this movie. It's his son of a different name in the other movie and his stepson in the book, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know what the fucking difference is between little Johnny and little Kevin and stepson and real son. But anyway, it's a thing. But he has a moment in Manhunter where they have a little heart to heart. And for a second when it started, I was like, is this going to be about protecting mom? Who's going to protect mom? And it wasn't. It was about daddy had a hard time with something that went on because people are bad and men can have mental illness too. And men can struggle and it doesn't mean I'm not strong and it doesn't mean I can't protect you, but you have to protect yourself. I thought it was very elevated and ahead of its time, frankly,
I love
for a movie in fucking 86.
It's incredible. Like, it's really like, again, we've talked about this on the show for so many years of like, it doesn't have to be a Bechdel test passing film to be feminist.
That's right.
To be inclusive, to be intersectional. It can, you know, speak to things that everyone suffers with. And I think, you know, the more films like this destigmatize, having an honest conversation about mental health in a safe way with a child that you are caring for.
Mm-hmm.
Holy shit. That's
nice.
Still revolutionary in 2024.
Yeah. And even as we were talking about how Michael Mann treats his kind of like secondary lady characters, you know, I thought Molly was given a lot of credit.
Yeah.
You could tell that Will like not only loved and wanted to protect his wife and son, but he respected her and was like, I know I told you that I couldn't go back, but I have a responsibility. And I felt like she heard him. Neither of them were all about themselves. Like, those interactions really helped the film age well and brought me into it.
it.
Can I say, because we're going to talk about the ending and the director's cut of the ending in a second. Because they have that thing at the beginning of like the turtle eggs and everything. And then at the end, it's like Molly being like, oh, did all the eggs make it?
How many of them made it?
Most of them. Most of them made it.
And I was like, it's like him. He mostly made it.
Aww.
It sounds so cheesy. But, you know, I rewatched it, you know, 2 times in full before this episode. And each time it like fucking got me.
Yeah.
It just got me in the little black heart I have. But yeah, so the director's cut. There is a director's cut floating around. I watched it. I think the most notable thing is a scene that occurs between the killing of Francis Dolarhyde, which Will Graham does as he crashes through Dolarhyde's window to the climax of Inagata DeVita. And Andrea, last week you asked me what would I like to do for my 40th birthday.
Uh-huh.
And all I have to say is whatever we do, I want to make an entrance by crashing through a plate glass window to Inagata DeVita.
Okay, I can workshop that.
You got a year and a half. But so he does that, and it's just like heroic fucking, like he did it, and the madness is done. And then in the cut that most people have seen, it just cuts to him going back to Florida, talking about the turtle eggs, most of them made it, etc. Okay. However, in the director's cut, there is the scene where Graham goes to this new family's house, which is the family that Dolarhyde is beginning to target. So you see them a couple times. It's not totally clear in the new home videos. I had to look online to get triple clarification on this. And he shows up at the door and he's all fucking beat up from Dolarhyde. And the family doesn't know who they are. And like they're grabbing the gun to, you know, do away with him. And they realize who it is.
What do you want?
My name is Will Graham. I'm with...
Oh, yeah. Jesus, right. Come on in.
No, that's all right. You okay?
We're fine.
We're okay, yeah. And we're doing all right. Thanks. Listen, that guy Crawford called, and he was telling me all about what's going on.
Would you like to come in and have a cup of coffee or a drink?
No, thank you.
Listen,
I just stopped by to,
Listen, I want to thank you. I
just stopped by to see you. That's all.
And what Graham says to them is, I just wanted to see you. That's all. And the scene ends.
Hmm.
And to me, that was like, oh, so part of Dolarhyde has stayed with him.
Mm.
He just wanted to see, like,
ooh,
Dolarhyde saw.
I just wanted to see you.
Yeah. Because he just said, and he looks all fucked up, and it just ends.
Oof.
And it's like, I think that is a much more subtle and darker and complex ending to Will Graham, because that's not in the book.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just, it's so fucking haunting.
That is haunting. I wonder why they cut it.
Because it's complicated.
Like for 5 seconds?
Because it's complicated.
I don't accept that as a reason.
Oh, you work with enough film PR.
Oh.
It's really good. And I also think it kind of delves into the kind of nature versus nurture conversation that this story skirts around a lot.
Mm-hmm,
you know, is Hannibal Lecter fully evil because he was born that way? Was Dolarhyde made into a villain because of his upbringing, which is again detailed in the book? And then in some way is Graham, is there some part of him that is being, you know, radicalized in some way because of his proximity to these killers?
Yeah. It's not black and white, even for the good guys.
No, it is the biggest landscape of gray you could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where my happy place lives. And also in James Caan in Thief.
The yield of my labor.
So fucking sexy. And not to end this episode on a down note, can we talk a little bit about Brett Ratner's Red Dragon?
Yes.
Because I just have some thoughts.
Yeah.
And I wanted to share them with you.
I mean, like having seen that in the same evening that I saw Hannibal, it's blurry.
Wow.
The addition of the eating scene, a score by Danny Elfman, like these little stylistic flourishes that set it apart. And then, of course, the F-bomb.
Yeah. And so I will say for a long time, I would say probably my late 20s, when I used to go out on a regular basis. Red Dragon 2002, directed by Brett Ratner, was one of my favorite hangover movies.
Okay.
I think it was like on Netflix streaming or something that I had. So it was like I could just fall asleep to it. And everyone's perpetually restating the plot and where you are in the plot. And it's great. And it's like kind of trashy and dumb. And so I've seen this movie far too many times.
Okay.
I haven't seen it in a number of years. So I went back to rewatch and I was like, I basically remember this beat for beat. One of the important things to note about Red Dragon 2002 is that the screenplay was written by Ted Talley, who wrote the screenplay for Silence of the Lambs.
Okay.
So that's what got kind of people hot on it, especially after the disaster that Hannibal was.
Mm-hmm.
And after reading the book and, you know, spending a lot of time with Manhunter, because there's a character in the book and alluded to in the film in Manhunter, Dr. Bloom, who does some of the psychoanalysts.
Yes.
And all of that character, Dr. Bloom, gets turned into Hannibal Lecter in Red Dragon. This is all I could think of when I was watching Red Dragon 2002.
Hi, Mr. Myers. I've been doing some thinking, and I got some ideas to improve the show. I got it right here. One, Hoochie needs to be louder, angrier, and have access to a time machine. Two, whenever Poochie's not on screen, all the other characters should be asking, where's Poochie? Three.
Great. Just leave them right there on the floor on your way out.
It is that, but about Hannibal Lecter. Everyone is like, Red Dragon is taking place somehow in a post-Silence of the Lambs era.
Yeah.
It is, everyone is just like, where is Hannibal Lecter? I wonder what he thinks about everything.
God, you're so right.
You know, we see all of the backstory with Dollar Hyde. He's played by Ralph Fiennes, and he's fine. But I wanted to call out two moments in particular that really jumped out to me,
mm-hmm.
because there is the eating of William Blake's painting,
mm-hmm.
which happens in the novel. Mm-hmm, and so they mm-hmm. bring it into this version, and it's just as silly as you would think.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, award-winning actor Ralph Fiennes stuffing
paper
into his mouth.
Yeah.
And like the music was rising and we're all supposed to be like, oh God, he's the dragon. And she's like, hump, hump.
He's a paper eater. We had those in second grade.
And then finally, like, you've got the incredibly talented Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Freddie Lance.
Oh, he was great.
He was great. And he sold the shit out of the scene where Ralph Fiennes as Francis Dollarhart is like doing the do you see thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then finally, when he strips off to kind of show his back tattoo,
mm-hmm.
and you're kind of like, all I could think of was those tabloid paparazzi shots to bring it all full circle of Ben Affleck post-divorce with the Phoenix back tattoo.
Oh.
And it was meant to be, again, this like wah moment. And Philip Seymour Hoffman, to his credit, was playing it as a wah moment.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh.
It's just a back tattoo.
It's just a fucking back tattoo, you fucking normies. What is happening?
Check out my ink.
Yeah.
Got it on spring break last year.
Anyway, those, I just needed to share those with everyone.
I so appreciate that you did. Thank you.
You're so welcome. Oh my God. Yeah.
So, I mean, to wrap up the episode, great choice, Alex.
Thank you. I loved getting to dig into it, and I loved hearing what you had to say about this.
Yeah, likewise. And next month, we are off to motherfucking Salem.
Yes.
So our next episode will be our live episode with, you know, all of the bloopers intact, whatever silliness we get up to that is bound to happen when it's live and in person. Tickets are available as we speak, but if you can't make it, that recording will be our April episode. So look out for that. And we are going to be tackling
Cat People.
Yeah.
From 1942, the original version. I fucking love this movie. This movie is maybe a big part of the new book I have coming out.
Mm-hmm.
So we will leave links to Salem Horror Fest in the show notes. So please, if you can make it out, check it out. It's going to be a lot of fun, and we'll be around for the whole weekend.
That's right. And as usual, things are cooking on our Patreon. You can join for as little as $2 a month. That will always be linked in our show notes as well. And until the next time you're kicked out of first class for doing your Faculty of Horror homework on a flight.
Office hours are closed.
You see my hands are steady. You've seen my face before. Soon you can take your last look, and they'll close the door. I stand accused before you. I have no tears to cry. Till the day I die. A criminal mind is all I've ever known. They tried to reform me, but I'm made of cold stone.
Something.